From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we'll explain what the constitutional amendments on the August primary ballot mean.
At a very basic level, these amendments set out to enlarge the power of the legislature at the expense of the executive branch.
We'll learn about the history and origins of the EAA. Plus, we'll tell you about the documentary Butterfly in the Sky, which tells the story of the beloved TV series Reading Rainbow.
Kids were watching television anyway, so let's figure out a way to put books in front of them. Let's figure out a way to still channel the parts of their imagination that books bring to life, you know, and that sometimes TV could squash.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. There's a partisan primary election coming up on August 13th, and for the first time in Wisconsin history, there will be two constitutional amendments on that ballot. Up until now, any constitutional amendments have been voted on in spring and fall general elections, when turnout is higher. And these amendments could have a big impact on how the governor is able to allocate funds. The amendments propose changes to how the governor is able to designate federal aid money during things like a pandemic or major weather event. To help understand what the amendments are and what a yes or no vote means, Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez is joined by political science professor Phil Rocco.
There are these two amendments coming up. And before we get into kind of what they are and what they set out to do and what even an amendment is, are we seeing more of these, or is this just my imagination?
Yeah. So since 1854, voters in Wisconsin have voted on over 200 constitutional amendments. And the way that that works is the state legislature will vote on a piece of legislation. They have to do it in two consecutive sessions. Mm-hmm. And then if they approve it in both sessions, they will put it before voters. So this is coming from the legislature. And what we've seen in the last few years is a sort of increase in the number of those amendments. We're going to see three of them in the remainder of the year, two on the August ballot, one on the November ballot. And I think you could interpret at least some of these amendments as reflecting the state legislature's sort of understanding that the sort of political map is going to change. You know, we're going to be voting in new districts. There's going to be a little bit more competition. And I think that you can see Republicans in the state legislature trying to entrench some of their policy preferences through kind of putting them before voters and trying to get them put on the books as a constitutional amendment, which is much harder to undo than simply repealing a law.
If we can dig in.
Sure.
What are we being asked in this first question, the delegation of appropriation power? Because this is very opaque language for people to try to make sense of.
Yeah. So we've got two constitutional amendment questions on the ballot, but you should really read them together. So the first one asks if we should add an amendment to the Constitution that prevents the legislature from delegating its power to appropriate money to the executive branch, for example. And then the second question is whether or not the Constitution should be amended to specifically prohibit the governor from allocating any money that the state of Wisconsin gets from the federal government unless the Wisconsin legislature specifically approves it. So let me try to break that down. This is really an set of amendments that's about the money that Wisconsin gets from the federal government. So aid from Washington accounts for about a third of our state budget. And there's a significant chunk of that money that when it comes in, the governor gets to decide what to do with it. And think about all of the money the federal government gave Wisconsin during COVID or during the Great Recession. That's unanticipated money. And so when it comes in, the governor gets to decide how to allocate it. And you can understand, like in an emergency context, this power goes all the way back to the Great Depression. This sort of authority was given to Wisconsin governors back in 1931. It's the midst of the Great Depression. And the idea is when there's an economic emergency, when there's a natural disaster, the important thing is for the aid to be able to get out to people who need it across the state quickly. And if you think about the legislative process, if it requires going through two chambers of the state legislature or being approved by the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, this is something that we know based on how it works in other contexts in Wisconsin, that that can take a really long time for the money to get out there. And so what are we talking about? What is this money? What does it do? During the pandemic, the state of Wisconsin was sort of one of the leaders in forwarding aid to small businesses. If you look across 50 states, Wisconsin sort of ranks like number one in terms of the money it allocated to small businesses. I think it over 110,000 small businesses got aid from the state of Wisconsin during the pandemic. And it went out, if you compare Wisconsin to other states, it went out relatively quickly. Whereas other states, it took a very long time, and there are other states that still have spent a very small percentage of the money that they got from the federal government during the pandemic. And I think you can look at the Wisconsin governor having that authority as one reason why. And so what these amendments would do is make it impossible for that money to get out as quickly as it did during COVID, because they would require that the state legislature steps in and gives explicit approval before the governor decides how to allocate that aid.
Okay, so it makes sense why we're seeing these as a package then. They're very complementary, it sounds like. Is that the reason behind why we're seeing them now on Wisconsin ballots?
Yeah, so if you look at the origins of these amendments, I think anytime there's been a big economic emergency during the Great Recession and during COVID-19, there's always been rumbling in the legislature about the legislature's need to have more control over that funding. Now, back during the Great Recession, that was somewhat easier to negotiate because you had one party in control of both the legislature and the governor's mansion. And so there was a sort of power-sharing agreement in that money getting out the door. Now, this specific set of amendments came about during COVID-19 when the legislature was controlled by Republicans and the governor was a Democrat. And initially, the Wisconsin state legislature, when the ARPA, which is the big federal relief package aid, came into the state, they initially tried to pass a piece of legislation which restricted the governor from using the money unless he got approval for the allocations from this very unique committee called the Joint Finance Committee, which is a committee within the state legislature. It's dominated by Republicans. Evers vetoed that legislation. Now, had that legislation, you know, had he not vetoed it, it would have basically allowed the state legislature to put a block on the allocation of that aid until they were sort of approved of it. And we can see this because in other parts of the legislative process, that's exactly what the Joint Finance Committee does, is unless they approve it, state agencies can't spend the money. And this has held up spending of a variety of types for many months and sometimes years.
It's interesting because this back and forth between the governor, executive powers, and the legislature seems like it's been going on for a while in Wisconsin. What's the bigger political context here?
Well, I think there's two contexts I would talk about. So first, the most immediate one is in 2018, when Tony Evers was elected, that set off a new series of conflicts between the legislature and the governor. The governor had been a Republican, right, since 2011, and the legislature had been controlled by Republicans for a number of those years. And so easy enough for the legislature to delegate a lot of power to the executive branch. When the governor becomes a Democrat, even before he's inaugurated, the legislature passes a series of what are known as lame duck laws, which restrict the power of the executive branch, limits the ability of the executive branch to do certain things like sign on to Medicaid expansion or get involved in certain kinds of lawsuits without the legislature's explicit approval. And that's really the context we've been seeing during Evers' time as governor, is this increasing tete-a-tete between both branches of government. And often those conflicts sort of wind up before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. There's a deeper political context, too, that goes beyond Wisconsin, which is since the 1970s, conservative policy activists around the country, primarily an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, has been promoting legislation that would make it more difficult for state executive branches to allocate money that the federal government sends them without explicit approval of the state legislature. So we can see the origins of legislation of one kind or another like that way back in as early as 1978. And a number of states ended up adopting legislation that looks like that. But there is a bigger ideological conflict there about the ability of states to spend federal money. And I think you can see the roots of it in legislation like organizations like ALEC have promoted.
So there's a lot of history behind these amendments and kind of this route being taken in this, it feels like, almost battle between the legislature and governor or executive powers. What do amendments actually set out to do in the first place?
At a very basic level, these amendments set out to enlarge the power of the legislature at the expense of the executive branch. And you can see them as being part of this bigger, really partisan battle between a legislature that has tended to be controlled by Republicans and a state executive branch elected through statewide elections, which have tended in the Democratic direction over the last 6 years or so. And I think if you look at the votes approving the text of these amendments in the legislature, they're straight party line votes in both sessions that approved it. And so you can read them as part of that bigger conflict between a legislature predominantly controlled by Republicans, trying to enhance or expand its scope of authority over a executive branch that has been tending in the Democratic column.
Not to take all the fun out of voting, but how do you expect these amendments to do on the ballot, considering it's a special vote in mid-August? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah. An important thing about these amendments is this is the first time in Wisconsin history that voters have ever been asked to approve constitutional amendments during a primary election in August, which tends to be low turnout. Historically, every single other time that the state has voted on constitutional amendments, it's happened during a spring general election or a fall general election. Now, spring general elections do tend to be lower turnout too, but fall general elections, right now the trend is the turnout is about double what we would expect to see in August. So in August 2022, we saw, I think, a 27% turnout among voting eligible population in the state. That was a 40-year high. And there's some reasons for that, right? There is a very high-profile U.S. Senate election on the ballot in August in 2022. Right now, we're looking at congressional elections around the state, congressional primaries. But of Wisconsin's 8 congressional districts, there are competitive Republican primaries in 3 of those districts, competitive Democratic primaries in 2. So less turnout there. There's no competitive U.S. Senate primary in either column. And less than half of the state assembly seats are going to see competitive primaries. So it is likely going to be a very low turnout. And the one thing we know from the past is that Wisconsin voters tend to approve state constitutional amendments. One potential reason why is that, unlike other states, Wisconsin does not require plain language to be provided to voters about exactly what those amendments would do, who supports them, who opposes them, what are the arguments for and against. Wisconsin voters basically have to get that from media, from other organizations. The state doesn't provide it. When voters don't necessarily know what they're voting on, there can be a sort of anchoring bias towards a yes. There are, of course, exceptions to this. I would point to back in April of 2018, there was an effort to try to eliminate the state treasurer's office. There was a very strong no campaign on that measure, and voters defeated it in the April 2018 elections. So it's not inconceivable that voters would vote this down, but a lot depends on how the issue is framed, whether or not voters are getting information about it. And of course, I think the fact that we're going to see a lower turnout in the August primaries probably puts a damper on the sort of no campaign effort as well.
So a lot of this sounds like it's just on, you know, the public to figure things out for themselves, whether it's going through media or trusted channels. Who do we know that's taken stances either to back or oppose these amendments?
Yeah, so supporters of these amendments include several Republican state senators, Dale Kuyenga, Howard Markline, both Republican state senators in Wisconsin. There was also, during the legislative process, the state's main business lobby, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, supported it. Where opponents are concerned, there's sort of a coalition of organizations that includes the Wisconsin Education Association Council, which is the state's largest teachers union, the League of Women Voters, organizations representing local departments and boards of public health, conservation voters organizations in the state, the Wisconsin Public Health Association, the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. So there's sort of an organizational coalition behind the no campaign in both of these.
Phil, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us. Just a final question. Are there any other potential consequences with these amendments?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two ways of looking at the consequences of these amendments. The first is the kind of practical policy consequences. So when the state receives emergency aid, when there's a natural disaster, when there's an economic crisis, or like during COVID, when there's both a pandemic and an economic crisis, the question is, who is going to be able to decide how that money is spent? And right now, the governor's office is able to make that decision, speed the money where it's needed, and you don't have to go through the typical legislative conflict that we see in a lot of other issues. Legislative leaders who are right now during this moment in time of a different party than the governor, they don't necessarily support that arrangement. And you know, they want to give themselves the ability to intervene. That's what would happen if this passed. The second set of consequences related to that, which is this is a bigger political conflict between two different institutions that have been locked in battle with one another over a variety of things. So while the text of the amendments might seem to be obscure or even vague or ambiguous, it really relates to this much bigger battle for control of Wisconsin's political institutions, which I think is much more familiar to voters.
Phil Rocco is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. In about 10 minutes, we'll get an inside look at how the classic children's TV show Reading Rainbow was made. But first, we'll learn about the humble Milwaukee origins of the EAA, one of the world's largest organizations for aviation enthusiasts. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh is taking place this week. The event brings 10,000 aircraft and hundreds of thousands of plane enthusiasts to Oshkosh to take in the aerial sights and sounds. The EAA is one of the world's biggest organizations for aviation enthusiasts, and it was founded right here in Milwaukee. The EAA is perhaps best known for its museum in Oshkosh and its annual Air Venture Festival, the world's largest gathering of its kind. Dick Napinski is the Director of Communications for the EAA, and he shares the history of it with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
I think when I heard the full name of the organization, the Experimental Aircraft Association, it almost sounded foreboding, a little dangerous. When we say the term experimental aircraft, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, experimental is a term used by the Federal Aviation Administration as a classification for people who build their own airplanes, and in other uses as well. And it is a little bit of a misnomer. When you talk about experimental category aircraft, they're very often airplanes that are built from very standardized kits. There are thousands of these particular models in the air, about 1,000 new home-built aircraft that are put in the air every single year. So when this started to become something in the early 1950s, the FAA or its predecessor, the CAA at the time, really didn't have a place to put this new classification of airplanes. It certainly wasn't a factory-built aircraft. It wasn't a military aircraft. It wasn't a research and development aircraft. It was an honest-to-goodness personal airplane that people built and flew. So with a lack of any place to put it, they tucked it in the experimental category, and there it has stayed ever since. And Hence, when a group of people who built their own airplanes got together in Milwaukee back in January of 1953, they started calling it the Experimental Aircraft Association, but in the aviation world, it's known simply as EAA.
Now, we'll talk about the origins of the EAA in just a moment, but when we look at the folks who are members today, who's a member of this organization? Is it largely people who are building and flying their own planes?
It is people who are interested in recreational aviation in all of its forms. It could be people who build their own airplanes, and that really is the organization's legacy in a lot of ways. People who restore aircraft, people who simply fly aircraft, or those who simply love being around the idea of personal flight, that freedom that it gives a person, that ability to do what man has wanted to do for tens of thousands of years, and that's soar with the birds. And in the past 120 years, we've been able to do that. And so the people who are EAA members are those who have a passion for flight, whether it's as a pilot, a builder, or maybe just a dreamer. They're all part of the organization.
Now, the EAA today has grown into a huge organization, but it has very humble origins. Can you tell us a bit about that story?
It does have humble origins right in the Milwaukee area, and that's part of the fascinating story. Paul Poberesny, who was a Milwaukee native, grew up in the area, went to West Milwaukee High School, and grew up in that part of town. And when he got out of World War II and later the Korean War, where he was a veteran, he always had a fascination with flight, going back to his high school days when he was given a trainer glider by a history teacher, and Paul remanufactured it and put it together and went up for his first flight being towed behind a car, and went up, and he always said he learned very quickly to keep the nose up because things otherwise go. And so when he got back from the war, he had been talking to a group of people who were informally building their own airplanes. He said, why don't we start an airplane club so we don't have to meet in people's garages and airplane hangars and so forth. So they started a club on January 26th, 1953. There were about 35 people who came to what's now Timmerman Airport, the Grand Air building at Timmerman Airport, then known as Curtis Wright Field, on the northwest side of Milwaukee, and had that first meeting. They decided to call themselves the Experimental Aircraft Association, had yearly dues of the princely sum of $5, and started right there. And it was a very humble beginning, but it quickly grew to include others throughout the country who heard about this and wanted to be a part of it. And Paul then also stepped forward. He wrote an article in the mid-1950s for Mechanics Illustrated on how to build an airplane for less than $800. And that really got the attention of a lot of people who were hobbyists and aviation enthusiasts and so forth, and started the organization on its way. And it's grown today to include 270,000 members from more than 100 countries. All of those people are passionate about the freedom of flight and sharing that feeling of flight with others. And that's where we are today with EAA.
It's interesting looking at the origins. My grandfather was someone who flew in World War II, and there are so many veterans for whom this was a huge part of their service, where they were in planes all the time. They come back, maybe some become pilots, but so many go on to other things. And to have this kind of space where you can engage in something that was so much a part of your life is a really interesting experience. When you look back into the history of the EAA, what are the things you're most proud of?
Well, you're exactly right when you talk about veterans coming out of World War II and the Korean era. We trained so many pilots, tens of thousands of pilots during that era, who got a taste of flight. Maybe it was the first time they'd done that. We want to go fly with the Navy or the Army Air Forces, and came back and wanted to continue to fly. And this was a way they could do it economically. And they supplied the first great impetus of the organization in its membership. But when you take a look at what EAA has done through the years, it created an entirely new segment of recreational aviation where there was not one before. You had a few hobbyists throughout the country who would build their own airplanes as back early. Well, I guess you could say the Wright brothers were the first airplane builders, but you know, there were people building Heath airplane kits back in the 1920s, building things such as Pitot poles, but really formulating that together to standardize it, to say, here's what we want to do. Here's what we want to do to improve safety. Here is what we're looking for, how to share it, and so forth. So some of the things that we're most proud of, first of all, is bringing that element of standardization to amateur-built aircraft and looking toward ever-improving safety. Another thing we're very proud of is what our fly-in, our convention has become in Oshkosh every year, the world's largest fly-in convention with more than 10,000 airplanes and more than 600,000 people in attendance. Also, we're very proud of sharing the legacy of flight with a new generation. And as we look ahead toward the technology, toward the possibilities in flight, we're very enthusiastic about that. Our Young Eagles program has flown almost 2.3 million kids free of charge to introduce them to aviation. And a lot of those young pilots now are out there flying for the military or for airlines. And it's incredible to see. So those type of things, maintaining the legacy of home building, bringing people together in a way to enjoy it, and looking out for the future are probably the three things that we're most proud of in the organization.
Well, I look forward to seeing what is next for the EAA. Dick, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Dick Nepinski is the Director of Communications for the EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association. The EAA Air Venture in Oshkosh runs through this weekend.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
If you're a child of the 1980s or 90s, I bet that song sparked the urge to run into your living room and get ready to watch Reading Rainbow. I know I certainly did. The beloved children's literary television show introduced millions of kids to the wonder of books, not to mention the man that made the series what it was, LeVar Burton. A documentary called Butterfly in the Sky tells the story of the PBS children's series Reading Rainbow, from its iconic host, the people behind the scenes, and the challenges its creators face in creating a love of reading through television. I spoke with the documentary's co-director and editor, Bradford Thomason, in 2022.
We grew up with Reading Rainbow. It was Brett and I both, Brett Wickham, my co-director, and I, we both watched Reading Rainbow as kids. And the idea of Reading Rainbow, the influence on us had always kind of been there, even if we hadn't been, even if we weren't thinking about it. And, you know, one day Brett called me up and said, hey, you know, has anyone made a Reading Rainbow doc? And, you know, we looked it up and sure enough, no one had, which was surprising to us actually. But then we started doing research, you know, and once we found this group of people who made this show, you know, who poured their hearts into it, you know, each with their own journey, you know, we sort of felt like we really had an interesting story to tell, not just about the show, but about the, you know, the people who made it. And then, of course, the lives of young people who were impacted, you know, by the series.
Before we get into some of those amazing behind the scenes moments you give the audience, I want to talk about the landscape of TV at the time that Reading Rainbow was created. So how did people view television and what was Reading Rainbow created to do?
Yeah, I think that television, obviously, you know, been around since the 50s or whatever, but in terms of television as we know it now, you know, looking at it in 1981, 83, that era, it's still, you know, when you reflect on it now, it still feels like it was in its infancy because you had only a handful of channels, you know, national channels. And then of course, you know, I guess cable would have was starting to come in at that time, but that was a whole different world. A lot of people didn't even have it. And I think that the idea of how television could be used for education was still a new idea and still in development. I mean, Sesame Street obviously was there and had broke so much ground, you know, in the 70s. And I think that everyone working in that world, all the people in the world of public broadcasting, all the people who were trying to use television as an educational tool were aware of Sesame Street and following its model. But I think that Reading Rainbow was attempting to do something entire, you know, completely different because they wanted to bring books to TV in a very, you know, palpable way. Like they actually wanted to bring a book off the page, put it on a television, and sort of inspire kids to read more as a result of that experience. And, you know, I think that incorporating the documentary segments, sort of bringing the book to life, these were all new things that Reading Rainbow, you know, were bringing to television.
Yeah, on that note, things that the show did that were amazing for the time that I took for granted as a viewer were things like the importance of filming on location. So what other elements like this of the show stood out to you as setting itself apart from other children's programming?
The on-location shooting is obviously a big one. And Brett and I have both sort of acknowledged over the years that Reading Rainbow was likely the first documentary, TV documentary that we saw on television. Whether we, you know, we didn't comprehend it as such at that time, you know, we were just watching the book and then seeing what fun things LeVar did. But, you know, they would go to places and interview people and, you know, get the inside story on different parts of the world and the country. And that plus the way that the books were sort of presented, you know, it's kind of a slower animation style. And it's not really animation at all. It's, you know, cameras moving across book pages, you know, but it works with the pace of the storytelling, you know, and then of course the narration always done by, you know, a celebrity or someone with a unique voice, you know, all that sort of worked together to present a book on television in a way that still allowed a child to consume it as though it were a book on the page, you know, and, you know, kids are, you know, it's said in the film, but kids were watching television anyway. So let's figure out a way to put books in front of them. Let's figure out a way to still channel the parts of their imagination that books bring to life, you know, and that sometimes TV or often TV could squash, you know, and I think that was the idea. And then of course the third component is that there are kids on Reading Rainbow reviewing books for you, the kid viewer. So it's very unique. And again, you know, Sesame Street had lots of kids talking, particularly with the Muppets and stuff, but it's very unique to hear a child's opinion about a book, you know, about something, a child's review of something, you know, so that you can say, you know, I may or may not agree with that other kid, but, you know, I'm going to go form my own opinion now on something because, you know, Reading Rainbow just empowered me to do so.
Obviously, the one major person who's talking to the children through the camera so well is LeVar Burton, and he's obviously the perfect host for this program. We can't really imagine it with anyone else. So what was it like to meet and interview him, and what stands out to you about his hosting style that made this show so impactful?
I think it's a couple things, but with regard to meeting him, when we started formulating the idea, we knew we can talk about this, but we can't really make a Reading Rainbow documentary without LeVar Burton in it. You know, I mean, obviously it's, I don't want to understate how many people came together to make this show, but you know, he is the face of the show. He's the one that everyone remembers, and he's such an integral part of Reading Rainbow. And so, you know, one of the first things we did was track down his team and put in a call. We connected with someone over there. You know, we sent them a pitch deck. We sent them, you know, our idea for the film sort of all in one place, and kind of waited. And then one day got a phone call, and it was LeVar. And we just kind of were both speechless. You know, it was hard to talk. It was hard to reply on the phone the first time we heard his voice, because, you know, there's the voice of lots of hours of our childhood, you know, watching Reading Rainbow and Star Trek and, you know, Roots and other things that we had seen and loved that he had done. There he is on the other line, you know. But he liked what we presented. He told us he believed we were the right people to make the film. You know, he had seen some of our previous work. And so once we got his blessing in that way, we set off to make the movie, and then we sat down to interview him. It was the same thing all over again. There's LeVar Burton sitting across from us. You know, once we get through that, it's, you know, a really substantial interview with just amazing, you know, conversation and his insights into everything. And I mean, we couldn't have asked for a better person to help guide our story.
LeVar's authenticity was so important, and it's clear that that comes through in his hosting style. What stands out to you about his delivery, and what made him connect with children so well, both those who were in the show and how he connected through children watching at home?
I think LeVar was really good at sharing in the enthusiasm of the viewer. So, you know, if you're a young person watching Reading Rainbow and you're seeing the show, the cameras go to a volcano, a live volcano, you know, you're going to be very excited by that. And LeVar was right there at the volcano, sharing in that excitement in a childlike way, but not like a child, you know, which I think is a real sort of challenging line to walk. You know, he never came across like a big child. He just came across as, you know, your cool uncle who was as excited about these things as you are. And, you know, for me, it's you know, we touch on it in the film, partially because it was such a big impact on us, but, you know, just his appearance, his earring, which we talk about, you know, I, as a young person seeing that, it had an impact because I felt like I was seeing someone really cool on PBS who was teaching me something, you know. And I don't know that PBS, I love public broadcasting. I love Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I have amazing memories watching that show as well. But it wasn't particularly cool, you know. And as I started to get a little older, you know, like it got less cool, but LeVar didn't, you know, like he, and it was partially because the producers took him to places that were connecting with a growing audience as well, but he was cool. And, you know, his sort of communication with the viewer was never condescending. You know, it was never like you were talking to, you know, I think Twyla Liggett would say, you know, that a lot of these kids shows, they talk to kids like they're puppy dogs, you know, and LeVar never did that. He talked to you like you were his peer. And he talked directly to you, you know, in such an empathetic and kind way.
Another important part of that was the fact that LeVar was a Black host in the landscape where this was not common.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that was certainly on the minds of the producers. They knew that, you know, boys were disproportionately affected by reading issues, difficulty reading, boys, and particularly, you know, young African-American boys. So I think that they wanted to find a host who would connect with that group. And, you know, thankfully PBS at that time, you know, even with Sesame Street, you know, they were breaking ground all over the place. And so it feels like a very groundbreaking thing, and it was, but it was also in line with the kind of ground that PBS had been breaking since Sesame Street.
I do want to touch upon someone you've brought up a few times, Twyla Liggett, and also the co-creator, Tony Butino. Can you share more about the creators of Reading Rainbow?
Yeah, you know, Twyla and Tony, they were kind of like two individuals coming from different perspectives. I mean, Tony Butino was a broadcaster out of Buffalo, WNED TV. He had worked with for many years. And I think he started on the ground level, on the grassroots level, talking to librarians, talking to teachers about how can we get kids reading in the summer? Because, you know, he had become aware of this summer reading loss phenomenon that, you know, basically when kids home for the summer, they lose a lot of the skills they had developed during the school year. So he wanted to use television primarily because he was just a family guy and he, you know, loved his kids and wanted to do right by children. And he wanted to use this medium that he had kind of at his fingertips to help kids continue reading. So he tried all kinds of things. I think it was, I think at that level, you know, there were limited budgets and there were things like that that prevented him from sort of finding anything that stuck in Buffalo. But, you know, Twyla Liggett, who, you know, had a background in teaching, she had been a music teacher, she had been a reading teacher, then she got involved with grant writing and she got a job at another public television station, I believe Nebraska Educational Television, and her boss there also had an interest in making a reading program for kids. And he had been having conversations with WNED and, you know, it all just kind of came together. So the research and work that Tony Butino had done in Buffalo and Twyla's sort of acumen for finding money and getting what she needed to make the show, plus her, you know, love of reading and her work in teaching, all came together to make this show. And they, you know, they got what they needed and they made a pilot, and then the Center for Public Broadcasting approved the pilot and they were off and running.
Reading Rainbow unfortunately came to an end after 26 years because of a loss of funding after the No Child Left Behind Act. And for the show and the people who made it to be told that the show had, quote, no measurable impact in a time where testing scores took priority was pretty heartbreaking. And I don't think any other show has succeeded in the way that Reading Rainbow has with impact and reading, at least for people of my generation. How do you view its legacy and how do you hope this documentary shines a light on that?
Yeah, I mean, from the minute we formulated this idea, from the minute we started telling people that we were going to make a Reading Rainbow documentary, the response was just overwhelmingly positive in memory. I mean, everyone we talked to, they started singing the song, they would, you know, reflect on their favorite episodes. Then they would say, oh gosh, I need to read more, you know? And I think that that's what we get a lot when people watch the film in a public setting as well, is they leave inspired, they leave obviously reflecting on the show and their memories of the show, but they also leave sort of saying, gosh, you know, books were such an important thing to me when I was young, or books still are, and I want to go read another one. But I think that the show and the film both can inspire people to read, to encourage kids around them to read. And I think that's one layer. And then of course for us, you know, we were just so enthralled and so taken by the people who made the show and just how passionate they were and what it meant to them. You know, I mean, you said it, the show ended after a long time and the impact is immeasurable. And yet the people in our film, you know, they reflect on the end of the show as a great loss for them, you know. And I think that that's another part of our story, is, you know, walking away just understanding and empathizing with the passion and the creativity that went into the show from all these wonderful people. Take a look, it's in a book,
a reading rainbow. Bradford Thomason is the co-director and editor of the documentary Butterfly in the Sky, which is about the PBS show Reading Rainbow. You can now watch it on Netflix. We'll take one more break and then tell you about the legend of the Pfister Hotel ghost and hear some stories from the historic hotel's guests. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. A reading rainbow. A reading rainbow. A reading rainbow. A reading
rainbow. A reading rainbow.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Pfister Hotel was packed with people last week visiting for the Republican National Convention. Former President Donald Trump was rumored to be one of those guests. And there's rumors of something else at that historic hotel, a ghost. The Pfister is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It also frequently makes it onto lists of Wisconsin's most haunted places. It attracts celebrities and sports figures, some of whom have reported unexplained events during their stay. Anna Lardnoy is a former Pfister Hotel narrator and the owner of Gothic Milwaukee, which offers walking ghost tours in the city. She spent a lot of time researching the history of the hotel and joins Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen to share more about the legend of the Pfister Hotel ghost.
Let's start with just a little history of the Pfister Hotel. What can you tell us about it?
Well, the Pfister Hotel is one of Milwaukee's most beloved institutions. It started as a dream of Guido Pfister. He wanted to have the finest hotel in the region, and he dreamed up the Pfister Hotel. Now, unfortunately, he dies before the hotel is finished, but his son, Charles Pfister, seamlessly steps in. He completes the hotel and then is Milwaukee's perennial host until his death. He loved the hotel so much, and he did everything he could to make his dad's dream come true of how grand the Pfister could be.
So we're talking about some of the legends at the Pfister Hotel, including the Pfister Hotel ghost. And you say that that legend started even before the hotel was built. So what can you tell us about the origins?
Well, I sure think so. Now, I, as you may know, was the Pfister narrator on its anniversary year, and I did a lot of research on the hotel itself, which was a fascinating journey into the past, and got to uncover all the many famous people who stayed there and the fancy balls they had and the delicious meals. And as I was going through, always being aware of the legend of the Pfister ghost, I ran across some reminiscence from what we called at the time a very uncomfortable title for modern people, but the person known as the first white boy born in Milwaukee. He was interviewed throughout his life by local papers to reminisce about times of Milwaukee's past, because we've always been fascinated by our history. So on his 57th birthday, there was quite a large party for him at the Old Settlers Club. And this was another time that he was interviewed and reminiscing about the past. The article that I found is from May 5th of 1893. It was published in the Milwaukee Daily Sentinel. And he was talking about a time in the past where he lived in a log cabin that was on the land that now holds the Pfister. And he reminisced that it was also a private burying ground. And he references someone named Dr. Wilcott. Two of his family members were buried there. And then goes on to talk about, as the hotel, they were breaking ground for it, he went to the property to look for the bones of some of these people and could not find them. So that is, I think, where this legend truly begins, that this hotel is built on land that had once been graves. I think the story kind of morphs as time goes on. As somebody who owns a ghost tour, I get stories all the time from people who've had experiences at the hotel. And one of my very first tours over a decade ago, there was a man and his wife who came on the tour that said his grandfather had actually died in the hotel. He was an elevator operator, and he died in an accident at the hotel. And into his youth, his grandmother used to pack up sandwiches, and they would go to the hotel and visit the grandfather. So, and we all know of the famous story that Joey Lawrence tells about being visited by the spirit of a rumored dead bride. So there are lots of different ghost stories that go along with the hotel, and to be honest, with all classic hotels.
Yeah, everyone from professional baseball players to celebrities have shared some eerie experiences at the Pfister Hotel. Can you talk about some of the more notable sightings that people have reported?
Well, I think that definitely the most famous stories are connected to Major League Baseball. And, you know, the legend continues to grow with that. When I was in the hotel the summer of 2018, that was the very exciting news of the Cardinals pitcher who woke up in the middle of the night, jumped onto Instagram saying that he had just been touched by the Pfister ghost. Well, the next day he plays terribly. He blames it on the Pfister ghost, and the city cheers. So how do you not love the Pfister ghost who just wants the Brewers to win?
Right. So there's the thinking that it is Charles Pfister who is the Pfister Hotel ghost. There's also this kind of the age-old woman in white. Is there just a Pfister Hotel ghost, or is there a few different legends at the hotel?
Well, I think that there are a lot of different stories, but I think when we talk about the Pfister ghost, we most often are talking about Charles Pfister. Now, I've had so many people tell me because of being the ghost tour and working as the narrator that they've had personal encounters with Charles Pfister, that they've seen him standing in that minstrel's balcony overlooking the Imperial Ballroom, or they've caught him walking late at night on the floor that had his suite of rooms. But I think because Charles Pfister is so closely connected with this hotel, he becomes kind of the spokes ghost. And if you had to have a ghost in a hotel, I can't think of a better one than Charles Pfister. Because Charles Pfister, it appears, just wants you to have an amazing time in his hotel and wants the hometown baseball team to win. And how do you not love that ghost? You might know that when Megan Thee Stallion was in town for Summerfest, she and her entourage did some Instagram posts about their ghost hunting experience in the hotel. And if you believe Thee Stallion, and who doesn't, she had a ghostly encounter there.
The Pfister Hotel is on lists of most haunted hotels in the country, also been listed as one of the most haunted places in the state. What kind of notoriety do you think the Pfister brings to Milwaukee, not just as a historic hotel, but one filled with folklore and legends?
Well, as someone who works in the tourism industry, I know that the Pfister is a purposeful destination for people who like haunted tourism. And I think that that's a wonderful asset to the city. I am biased by being in absolute love with the Pfister, and I think it has something for everyone. You can go there for the elegance. You can go there for the fabulous service. You can go there for the ghosts. You won't be disappointed at the Pfister. So I think it's a tremendous asset to the region. I think that the legend is a delightful one, especially when you think of the things that it could be. You know, it's not a terrible murder. It's not anything gruesome. If you think of the Pfister ghost as Charles Pfister just with a careful eye watching over his hotel, it's actually quite delightful.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us again here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Stay spooky.
Anna Lardnoy is a former Pfister narrator and the owner of Gothic Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, X-Grad Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Susan Benz from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Madernowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Running through your head, who can you call? Ghostbusters! An invisible man sleeping in your bed.